Welcome back to Calling Hours, a Homesteaders podcast. I am so excited you are joining us today. We have a really exciting guest. Joining us is Barbara Chemist. She is the executive director of the Cremation Association of North America. And it just was so generous with her time and her thoughts and her expertise. We talk a lot about her path getting to the funeral space. She started out in library science. She was a librarian for many years and moved into association management. We talk about what's happening in the funeral space around cremation, the conversations that are happening, what the data is telling us. And she has some great stories of the ways that funeral providers are just knocking it out of the park in terms of serving these cremation families. So it's a great conversation. She's got such a great perspective on the cremation trends we're seeing in the United States and also just how we can elevate funeral service for those families. So I am so glad that you've taken time to listen to today's conversation. And with that, I will turn it over to Barbara. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for making time for this. You are such a busy woman that I'm very honored to be able to capture a little bit of your time this morning.
I'm so excited to be here, Danielle. I love the podcast. So longtime listener, first time caller. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, and before we went live, you were telling me you're in Seattle for a really interesting conference. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
Sure, because we're going to be promoting it and recordings after the fact, but yeah, so there's this first ever conference called the Death Care Super Conference, Building Bridges with the Profession. And it's a bunch of what I call reform groups. So think Funeral Consumers Alliance, Home Funeral Alliance, doula associations. Yes, there are at least 1 to 3 associations for everything on the face of the earth. And that is true in death care. And so Kana is sponsoring this along with some other industry leaders like Passages International and Amy Cunningham's Fitting Tribute, Green Funeral Practice, but a lot of reform groups. So I'm here to network and meet self-described death curious people who are looking for career paths to be doulas, because you know what? We need workers. And who knows, maybe their career path will lead them to be a funeral director. So I'm here to represent and meet a lot of interesting people.
I love that. I think you're someone who strikes me as in like very curious about kind of adjacent spaces. You're in the funeral space, you're in the cemetery space, the cremation space. So I love that you're there. I think it's a really interesting conference, and I'm excited for you to share more. I'm excited for your members to learn a little bit more about it. But let's back up and talk a little bit more about you and your career trajectory, because you've been at Kana for quite a while now, but you've not been in the funeral space for your entire career. So tell us a little bit about how you got started, how you made the leap into the end-of-life space.
Sure. So I'm a librarian by trade, which so I'm a strong generalist. I know how to find things. I know how to find answers. I love research. I love it so much. It's the favorite part. It's always been my favorite part of my job. But so I started out working in the library, actually in an association. So I provided reference services for members, but ran a library that was open to the public. And, you know, after 5 or 6 years, got bored with that and thought, well, what do I want to do? Do I want to stay in libraries, associations, what have you? So I moved to a library association. So there we go, the American Theological Library Association. So my members were seminary and divinity school libraries around North America. And I was director of member services, and I traveled a bunch to visit libraries, and was there 7 years and loved it. And then decided I wanted to be executive director. And I thought, okay, well, there's, you know, a handful of library associations, but there's a whole lot, tens of thousands of other associations. So I cast my net broadly. And a friend of mine said, passed on the Kana job description. She said, this is hilarious. The Cremation Association, you have to do this interview. You have to tell me how it goes. And the more I looked into them, I thought, well, this is the perfect size. It's in Chicago where I live. And I know about cremation. My family has embraced cremation for humans and pets. And it'll be good practice. I haven't had a job interview in 7 years. Let me throw my hat in the ring. And let me tell you, I did everything wrong. I was late to the phone interview. My phone didn't work right. I talked too fast. I didn't think I was going to get an in-person interview, but they gave me one because it was local and they didn't have to fly me in. And then, so it was like the first interview after the board had been out all day, out evening. I mean, so I walk into this interview after traveling myself for my job, realized didn't have my resumes, didn't have my notes. I'm like, oh, this is. And I just put my hands, folded my hands and put them on the table and thought, I just need to get through the next 45 minutes. But I blew this, but it's going to be a good story. And about halfway through, I thought, wow, I'm really sad because the questions they're asking me are so interesting. And the more I learned about funeral service from this experience, and it was board members who were interviewing me, so most of them were owners and managers. And as they described the communities they served and the challenges they faced in their businesses, I thought, this, oh, why did I blow this? I was so sad. Well, I didn't blow it. In fact, they offered me the job later that day. And 13 years later, here I am talking with you. And my rule of thumb has been whenever I've changed jobs, it's because I've been bored. And it's, you know, you feel it, right? When you get bored with something.
Yeah.
And I vividly remember having thoughts like, I cannot do this again, like this annual cycle or event or whatever. I just can't do it again. It's too much. And that's a sign for me to move on. Well, 13 years in, not a boring thing about the funeral profession. That's for sure. It's ever changing.
There's so much in that answer that I just want to unpack. Like, one, libraries are just so near and dear to my heart. I'm an English lit major. I love, 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 love books. My kids love books. I have a team member who works in the library. Like, we are big library people. And so I love hearing that that is near and dear to your heart too, because I think that personally, the best people spend time in libraries. And you articulate it so well. You know how to find things. You know how to do your research. You have a broad understanding of the world because you visited all these different places through all these different stories. I love that. And I love hearing the story of how you ended up at Cana. We're in a season at Homesteaders on our team where we're recruiting. It feels like we're constantly recruiting new people. And I'm just having like a visceral reaction to like what that interview experience must have felt like for you. But I'm so glad it worked out, because I can't imagine Cana with anyone else at the helm. I mean, you've done such a great job, and I love watching you in this space. I love watching you interact with other end-of-life professionals, but also your team. Your team loves you. Like, you've just done such a beautiful job of leading that organization. So I'm glad that even though you didn't have your resumes for that interview, they still gave you a chance.
Yeah, thankfully they didn't ask for them. So there you go. They had no idea. They thought I just memorized everything and was just a superstar. So
there you go.
It's also a lesson in, I think, self-talk, because I left that interview convinced there was no way I was going to get the job, right? Like, I had held myself to this set of standards that mismatched what they, you know, anyway, it's a lesson too. Don't be so hard on yourself.
That's so interesting. We talk a lot about in the hiring cycle, like gender differences and how women approach job interviews versus men. And I'm terrible with numbers. So as someone who's a research person, this is probably going to appall you, but I think it's something like women will apply for a job only when they meet like 70% of spec, when they have 70% of the relevant experience, and men generally will apply if they have like 10%. It's like incredibly broad spectrum. And so I think it is something that women struggle with more than men, but there is an element of that going into an interview, going into that context and being comfortable and recognizing that it has to be a good fit for both sides. And so even if it feels like you really want that job, you also need to do kind of the investigative work to make sure that it's, you know, it's a good fit for you. So I love
that. I've seen similar stats, but what you just said is the most important advice. Like, that's why halfway through the interview, I was so sad that I convinced myself I'd blown it, because I was interviewing them as well. I wanted to make sure I could serve this population and get to know these specific board members and who, you know, by extension, the members they represented. And oh, I was so, you know, enthusiastic about serving them. So apparently that came through in the interview, obviously. But yeah, you know, I wanted the job, sure, but I wanted it to be a good fit. So that's really important advice you gave, to interview back, basically, make sure, you know, test to make sure it fits. Yeah.
Wow.
It's always a fun story and a nice
it is.
I live that.
I'm so glad you shared it, because I didn't know that about you. And that's, yeah, it's a nice broadening of my knowledge of you. I'm excited to know that story. So you've been with Cana 13 years, and the funeral space is different today than it was 13 years ago in a number of ways. And you've kind of been able to steer the ship a little bit in some of that, particularly as it relates to cremation. I'm curious, with your expertise and kind of the broad view that you have, what do you see as the main challenges facing funeral and cemetery providers right now as it relates to cremation?
Well, okay, I'm gonna take some liberty here and say the number one challenge facing the space is workforce, and that's not unique to cremation by any stretch. But it's related to cremation in a way, because I think the second biggest challenge, and I hear it all the time when I go to even Cana events, but especially other events, is there's a persistent bias and myths around cremation in our funeral space. And with biases, there's always like a kernel of truth, right? There's a little bit of truth that started it. And by this, I mean, I can't tell you how many people I talk to who really believe, because consumers are saying this to some degree, that they're choosing cremation because of price, right? And so that must mean that professionals must offer the lowest price ever. And that impacts profitability. So I'm just going to say it plain, cremation profitability is an ongoing challenge. By and large, Cana members have figured it out. They've diversified their offerings along the cremation continuum from direct cremation all the way to cremation with services. But because this is such an ongoing challenge in the profession, a lot of our research, especially consumer-focused research, is digging into, what does that mean when a consumer says it's about price? And what we've found in this research is it means a lot of things. It means I want to be a good consumer, so I chose the lowest price thing because I'm frugal, or I did my research, or my spouse or parent said they wanted this because they wanted us to spend money on other things. None of that is the cheapest, lowest price, right? None of that equals that. By and large, there are some consumers out there who are always going to choose the cheapest, lowest price and deal with consequences. Mm-hmm. But I think that, funeral professionals have to recognize that they're, and build up their own sense of value and what they're offering families. Because it would break my heart, and I see this as a potential path, but it would break my heart if the funeral profession just came down to disposition, right? Mm-hmm. Without any services, without any grief support, without any aftercare, without any pre-need education, all of those things. It would break my heart if that's what it came down to. And I'm not disparaging businesses that have centered on direct disposition, typically cremation, but other forms of disposition too. More power to you. There's a need there. There's a market for it. But that's not what gets funeral professionals out of bed in the morning, right? And motivated to sit with grieving people and groundskeepers, keeping up cemeteries and talking to people who are visiting their people at the cemetery. Like there's a different ongoing connection, a different element of service and commitment and community engagement in the funeral professional. That's amazing. I mean, the funeral profession. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. It's amazing. And I would hate for that to go away and have it just be completely industrial. So I think that's the dystopian possible future we're avoiding, right? Nobody really wants that. We kind of had a taste of it during the pandemic to a degree. We know how bad it can be when we can't offer services, right?
Well, and I remember that season being really hopeful about the future of the profession during COVID. Obviously, what was happening in the immediate future was really hard and really difficult and was disproportionately on the shoulders of end-of-life caregivers because they were having to deal with the deceased and try and keep themselves and their staff safe. But I also, in the midst of all that, felt like there's this inherent hopefulness in recognizing that when you pull all of the gathering out of funeral service, when you pull all of the ceremony and the celebration out of it, you get down to what it looks like when it's just disposition. And no one liked that experience. That was not good for anyone. And I felt like there was this opportunity there to start to shine a light on why we do what we do beyond just caring for the physical remains. There's so many other pieces to it and so many other components that help the grief process and help the, you know, just a lot of things that are important that we don't recognize before. And I love, and you've heard me talk about this before, I love talking about cremation, families who choose cremation and how they view price. You know, I have a whole presentation on this, but we ask our policy owners, those who choose cremation, why? Why did you choose cremation? And for three quarters of them, 74% in our last survey, it was for something other than price. There's always going to be a portion of them that is the less expensive option. But by and large, they're choosing it for things like convenience. They have people that live all over the country and they need a time to be able to celebrate, or they want something more flexible, or any number of reasons. And for those that do select it because of price, it's not just because of the ticket, the dollar amount, it's resource allocation. Yeah. I want to spend less on the disposition because I want to spend more on the ceremony, or I want to spend more on travel to get everyone here for a gathering. I'm allocating this pool of money differently, but I still want to spend money on this. I still want to make sure this is an accurate reflection of their life. So I think absolutely that price piece is a sticking point for a lot of funeral providers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think everything, I agree with everything you just said. I think you're spot on. And one of the lessons we learned through research too was when funeral consumers think about their budget, they're not just thinking about the bill from the funeral home or the cemetery, right? They're thinking about travel and flowers and food and everything that goes into that, which is interesting because in some cases, right, airfare is way more expensive than whatever they're ultimately paying for disposition if they're bringing in a lot of people or having a destination scattering or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it was really insightful that I don't know how like earth-shatteringly new a revelation that was. I think we all realize there's, and that's why I love research so much, there's never black and white, right? It's very hard to draw a clean line. There's intersections between all of these things. So to understand and observe a shift from a consumer saying, oh yeah, I did this because of price, but actually that's what we do in our family. We cremate. We wouldn't even know where to buy mm-hmm. cemetery space or whatever. Like that's feedback we hear sometimes. So it shifted from like the 2000, like late 90s, early 2000s into the 2010s. That's when the cremation rate was getting up nationally, getting into the 30-40%. And it was kind of this tipping point where the majority of families were still planning their first cremation and making a whole lot of new decisions, first time decisions around what their new traditions would be. Now we're to a point where there's still people planning their first cremation, I'm certain, but it's now we hear more family tradition. It's personal preference. Mm-hmm. It's what we do. Cremation is now nationally over 60%. And so in some states, as you mentioned, I'm in Seattle right now. I mean, it's 85% in the state of Washington. Like, try to find somebody who buries here. I mean, really, like if a consumer is just, unless they're in certain religious or other communities, it's going to be pretty rare. And it's been like this for a while. So people do what their peers do. It becomes mm-hmm. normal, right? Maybe they do something unique and personalized in addition to that. And a lot of services are happening in high cremation states. They really are. The question is whether they happen with the funeral provider's help or not. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting when you start to think about the people who are choosing cremation today. Most of them are not choosing their very first cremation, which mm-hmm. to me suggests they had a positive experience with the first mm-hmm. one. And whatever that looked like for them, I think that's a good sign for end-of-life caregivers to say, there's good in cremation. There's positive ways that we can meet families and delight them. And I imagine that there are a number of your members who are doing that well. What do you think, when you talk to your members, when you talk to other end-of-life caregivers, what advice do you give to them about how they can do a better job serving families who select cremation?
Well, I'll answer generally and then specifically. The first suggestion I offer is to unpack what your personal definition of cremation is. And if it's in any way negative, chances are they're thinking direct cremation. They're making a whole bunch of assumptions that the family choosing cremation means they're looking for the cheapest option. They're not going to want to do all of these things. So the specific suggestion I offer to kind of test that is with the next 5 cremation families you serve, if the first question you typically ask, and this is common, and there's a practical reason why this, you know, at the time of removal or first call or whatever, do you ask, will this be cremation or burial? Okay, don't ask that question first. Just don't. It'll come out, right? It'll come out. Ask different questions about, you know, the death story, right? The person who's just experienced death and who is making arrangements wants to talk about their person who just died and wants to talk about options. Jumping right to cremation or burial has a practical sense. You need to know, are you going to embalm this body mm-hmm. right away? Are you going to refrigerate? You know, like what, it's different kinds of paperwork. There's like, I get the administrative mm-hmm. impact and import of asking that question, but think about what it says to the family, because you've just jumped over anything related to this person who has died and the family is focused on that loss to disposition. And short-circuited any kind of emotional. It's almost like taking all the, you know, so whatever demographic information you need for the death certificates,
vital statistics.
Yeah, you know, jumping to that first before making a connection with the family. So, I mean, I'm not the first person to say this. I'm borrowing this from other people, but hold a little experiment and try this with families and see what happens and see how the conversation changes. I think too, and I can tell a personal story about this. My parents were pre-planned and prepaid for their direct cremation. And my father was adamant, no service. In fact, he wrote in his very distinctive handwriting, just cremate me, at the bottom of his contract. Mm-hmm. And so 6 years later when he died and my mom and I were in the arrangement room with the funeral director, he opened the folder and I saw my dad's handwriting at the bottom. And what the funeral director didn't know is my mom and dad and I had this whole conversation about, okay, introverted dad, you don't want anyone to see you after death and you don't want to make a big deal. And you'd rather we just not be sad that you've died, mm-hmm. but you can't control that because we love you and we're going to be sad. And my extroverted mother and myself needed a gathering. So we talked mm-hmm. openly about that at that point. And he said, okay, fine, just no open casket. That was his only request, and we honored it. The funeral director had mm-hmm. no idea, right? He saw this contract that paid for direct cremation, and he did everything right. He opened the folder, he handed it to my mother, an updated price list for her to keep, went through what that direct cremation included, and then he said, what do you think? Or some question along those lines, and got really quiet. He didn't make any assumptions that was still what she wanted, right? He didn't make any assumptions. And I was kind of ready to, because my mom and I had talked, and my mom said, well, we want to serve sweet tea and carrot cake at the reception, and the pastor will speak, and his favorite color was blue. Can everybody wear blue suits or blue ties? And we think we're going to have a couple hundred people. We like your new, you know, can we have the larger chapel? She'd just been at a funeral there a while. I mean, this, you know, direct cremation pre-planned and prepaid 6 years ago turned into a 300 person reception, right? That, mm-hmm. and had he not, I mean, we knew what we wanted, but I was so grateful that he just listened. He just listened to what yeah. we said. And I think, I mean, obviously he was an experienced funeral director. It wasn't his first time working with somebody who pre-planned a direct cremation. And when I'm guessing the answers varied from, we got it from here, thanks, just do the cremation, mm-hmm. To variations on what my family chose. And I think that's not dangerous, not at all dangerous. I think it's, what am I trying to say? A little off-putting to be quiet and listen, because you don't know what yeah. they're going to say and you don't know how you're going to respond. But try it, right? If you haven't already, I'm talking to your audience now. mm-hmm. And because I think what this is one thing that I think remains true. As people create these new traditions, even if they've planned cremations, and the first cremation we planned in our family was 1996, and everyone since then has been different mm-hmm. and personalized. Sometimes the cremated remains are buried. Often we're scattering, sometimes legally, not legally. And
I won't tell.
Yeah.
Okay, you, me, and whoever's listening to this podcast.
I confess it. I confess it openly because now at this point in my life, I regret breaking the rules. Mm. You know, I do. I mean, not that I don't believe we ruined an ecosystem and I don't believe we harmed anyone in doing what we did, but it was a little selfish to choose what we did, you know? So that's just my feelings now. I believe in memorialization now. And my baby boomer parents were like, no, we're moving in with you, you know, and we're both in our urns. And I'm like, okay, you're not staying with me forever. So, so, you know, we will have a dedicated cemetery space. So eventually for all the, I'm not passing on urns of ashes to my, the next generation. That is not going to be a family tradition. I'm here to say, but,
I remember, you know, the conference about this time last year, it was the ICCFA's fall leadership conference. Mm-hmm. And they had a speaker that asked like, okay, you know, what's going to happen the next generation, the generation after that, but what about the third generation? What are they going to do with these cremated remains? And how are you going to navigate? What does permanent memorialization look like? And she asked all of us, okay, your parents' name, your grandparents' name, your great-grandparents' name, what about your great-great-grandparents? And if you had their ashes, what would you do with them? And I think that that idea of what happens next is really important in the cremation conversation, because I think it gets lost a little bit in the shuffle. If you're not scattering, if you just have this urn, where does it go? Where does it live? What's the permanent location for it?
So true.
That's an important conversation.
It's so true. And I'm so grateful. There's a member funeral director. I grew up in Michigan, and he emailed me after doing a graveside burial, because he can't, my last name is pretty unique, and there's very few of us chemists in the world, especially spelled the way my name is. So we came across a gravestone that said chemist on it. So he took a picture of it and he sent it to me, and it was in a part of Michigan where I never lived. Well, it turns out it was my grandfather's grave, and his first wife. His first wife died when my father was 7 years old. So, and then he remarried very quickly after that. And so his stepmother is really who raised him and who I knew. But anyway, I thought, oh, that's really cool. I'm going to send that to my aunt because she lives in California, and she may not have visited this grave in decades. So I forwarded the email. Well, it solved a family mystery that I didn't realize, because now this is her father. Okay. But she was living in California with young children. She came back for the funeral, and she knew he was buried, and she had been at that cemetery at one point, but 50 years later, she didn't remember what it was called or where it was. And she didn't remember if he was buried with his first wife, her biological mother, or with her stepmother. And she just didn't know who to ask or how to find out. So this funeral director solved this family mystery that I didn't even know existed. And you're saying great, 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 you know, like 3, 4, 5 generations. Yeah. Sometimes it's one generation back that this information gets lost. And so I was grateful, you know, I think the funeral director told him the story, and I was grateful to be able to help her. I had no idea. She had this open question. My dad was gone at that point, so I couldn't tell him. But, you know, it's even in cemeteries, like this gets lost so quickly. And I don't think the point of, like, I don't think my motivation for placing my parents' urns and eventually my urn and whoever else family urns I end up inheriting over the next decades in a cemetery is about, you know, that I have expectations of younger generations visiting me or what have you. I just think it's important to have a dedicated space for that. And not scatter in some place that I'll remember, but nobody else will. And that's not where you're supposed to scatter anyway, or it gets developed into a parking lot or, you know, housing or whatever. And, and I know there's plenty of people who scatter and feel very differently. They want to release that person to the wind. They don't want permanent, you know, a permanent placement. They don't want a permanent marker. It's a very personal decision. And so it's just interesting that by doing it certain ways and my reaction to that, I am where I am now. And I think that funeral professionals can help people through that. I was speaking at a funeral directors association last week, and I used this concept of 5-15-50. And I don't know if we've ever talked about that. Do you know 5-15-50?
I don't think so.
Okay, if one of your listeners actually coined this concept, please contact me, because I like to cite my sources. And but I learned this. I don't remember who taught it.
The librarian.
I know. I mean, credit where credit is due. So I didn't come up with that, but I'm happy to share it. So 5-15-50. When my father died, I said to my mom, "What do you want to do with Dad? He's in this beautiful urn. Oh, I'm keeping him with me." I'm like, great. Okay. So easily for the next 5 years, and it's been more than 5 years now, she will live independently. And he's on her bedside table, and it's perfect. They talk every day. It's great. I said, what about in 15 years, mom? Because you're not going to be alive then. Well, we're moving in with you. Okay. We're moving in with you in 15 years. So it's your decision. Okay. What about in 50 years? Because I won't be alive in 50 years and I don't have children to, you know, to leave these urns to. And then we had a real discussion. And so obviously not every funeral professional can say to the family in front of them, you know, 5, 15, 50, have you thought about this? And really get into family dynamics in that way. At need is probably not the right time. Maybe pre-need, there's more of an opportunity. But maybe there is. Maybe there was a way to say, especially to cremation families, that what my father wrote on the bottom of that page, just cremate me, we talked about a service, but we never talked about permanent placement with him. He never asked if he wanted to be scattered where we scattered my brother and other family members or with me. My mom obviously wanted to be with me. You know, so it was, we didn't, I don't know. To this day, I don't know what he wanted. My guess is he didn't think about it either because he would be gone. We'd see each other in heaven. He was more focused on that than what happened to his ashes. And I think that's very common. And a lot of surviving family members never had that conversation about permanent placement. They don't know the logistics of scattering. They don't know that cemeteries have beautiful cremation gardens and dedicated spaces or traditional burial for that matter, right? I mean, the whole spectrum. They don't know that those things exist. So, I mean, Cana is very dedicated to that. Our tagline is preparation for memorialization. And that's hard. That's hard to live these days because consumers have to do that, but we still promote it.
I really love that idea of 5, 15, 50, because I think there's a lot of opportunity there for funeral providers, because now all of a sudden you've extended the life cycle of these families. You've extended the lifetime value of them in terms of what you can generate with revenue, because thinking about you and your mom 15 years down the road, when the time comes that you want to move your dad to somewhere more permanent, you're not going to want to just hand him off, right? You're going to need to have some sort of ceremony to recognize that, like, that's another goodbye for you and for your mom. She's lived with him on her bedside table for 15 years. And the transfer to a garden, the transfer to a niche, whatever that looks like, that's another transition that needs to be acknowledged. And I think that's a space that funeral providers can really be of value that they're not serving today. But that is, yeah, I've never heard 5, 15, and 50. That is such a smart way to talk about that.
I hope your listeners will try it out and see what happens. Because even if there's no in-depth conversation in the moment, it's food for thought in the future. And these conversations will continue among generations of a family. So, yeah, we'll see.
I feel like I could talk to you for hours and we've only gotten through like two of my questions. So I'll ask you a few more and then I want to be respectful of your time because I know you're very busy, but research is very near and dear to your heart. Every single time I talk to you, I learn something new. There's something you're learning. There's data you're sharing. What has been surprising to you in your time at Cana around the research that you're doing? And why do you think it's important for funeral and cemetery providers to be paying attention to the data?
Okay, I'll start with the second question. I think data-driven decisions are critical. And I mean, your hunch, trust your gut, trust your intuition, trust your experience for sure. But if you don't have data to back that up, then maybe you're wrong. Maybe you're second-guessing yourself too much. And sometimes the data does surprise you and point you in different directions. I think what's most surprising about the consumer research in particular that we've done is how quickly consumers' attitudes are changing. And you could argue, I would think death care would be, you know, like a very staid, traditional profession. I came from the library world where the internet changed everything. Everything was all of a sudden allegedly available free online, right? And so what was the purpose of libraries? That was when I was working in libraries, is that attitude. No, death care is the most rapidly changing profession I've ever experienced. I mean, look at it. It's all driven by consumers. It's all driven by consumer attitudes. And I think this generational shift that we're coming into is one of the biggest, because everything's pointing to baby boomers having a certain set of values and kind of DIY, minimalist, anti-burial, pro-cremation, pro-new forms of disposition. It's all generalization. Of course, it differs to the individual. But Gen X and millennials, probably different, right? Probably different. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be cookie cutter. And so but it's consumers driving all of this. And so what's absolutely unsurprising is the continued predictable increase of cremation. It's 60.5% in the United States. It's going to continue to increase. We think it's going to plateau somewhere in the 70s, 80s nationally. We're about 10 years behind Canada, and that's what's happening in Canada right now with the cremation rate. So prepare for that. But consumer attitudes toward cremation are changing. It's not direct cremation entirely. It's with services. It's but just don't leave them in a position where they only can do it themselves. Like give them options, show them images of what their new traditions can be. Yeah.
Yeah. Ask those open-ended questions and ask them at the beginning of the conversation, not at the end. Well, I have a couple more questions for you. And these are questions we ask for every podcast guest. And the first one is incredibly selfish because I'm a reader and I love book suggestions. So tell us what you are reading right now.
Okay. So I read a lot of things all at once and take a long time to finish things. So I like to have, so right now I'm reading, I'm actually really behind because we're just coming off our convention. So there wasn't a lot of time just to read.
It'll be a pass.
Yeah. So I read as much of the trade publications as I can in the profession. I mean, Funeral Director Daily, Funeral Service Insider, like all sorts of, I listen to a lot of podcasts, other things. I'm sorry if I've left out stuff, but those are the things that and I have this reading folder in my email. And then when I'm waiting in the TSA line or otherwise just trapped with my phone and nothing else to do, I try to work through those things. I read association stuff too, because associations are challenged as well. I also like a good mystery or trashy romance because, you know, you can't always be focused on stuff. But I like, and I reread classics like Pride and Prejudice at least once a year.
Good one.
I love that book so much. It's so well written. It's so, you know, too much pride, too much pride, the romance aside, but yeah.
I love that. I like that you're reading in the like TSA line. There's a book I read a number of years ago by Jessica Turner. It's called The Fringe Hours. Mm-hmm. And she's talking about those little pockets of time that are normally just wasted. Like you are waiting for food at a restaurant or you're in your car waiting for in the pickup line for your kids or you're in the TSA line. And what can you do to fill those 5 or 10 minutes that saves you time down the road? And so she would travel with like note cards so she could always write thank you notes or things like that when she had a few minutes, or she would jump into an app. I think she was using Duolingo to learn some new languages and things like that. Or you can read the Cremationist magazine or whatever it is that you have in your to read list. So I love that. The last question, and we ask this of every guest, and this can just run the gamut. The answers are across the board. But what is giving you energy right now?
It's giving me energy. I'm entering a busy travel season where I represent Cana. Either by attending meetings I'm on the executive committee of the American Board of Funeral Service Education for Cana. So I have those kind of very committee, you know, nitty gritty, not in the spotlight type of meetings, coming up. And I love to be surrounded by smart people shaping the future of funeral service, right? So that has to happen. And it happens in these meetings with primarily volunteers. I mean, I'm blessed to be paid to do this kind of thing. Tonight, I'm mixing with all these, you know, and tomorrow with these funeral reformers, so-called reformers. So I get energy from, I'm an extreme extrovert. I get energy from meeting people and interacting with people. Probably my favorite thing to do is continuing education presentations. So upcoming, like I go from this group to the Catholic Cemetery Conference next week, and then a couple of more cemetery conferences in coming weeks. And it's fall, so it's cemetery conference time. And I love cemeterians, because if there's any group that's been hit the hardest by direct cremation, it's cemeterians, because that's what changes the price equation, skipping the cemetery. And it's a shame because it's creating a problem. 26% of U.S. households have cremated remains in their home and no plan. of what to do with them. Mm-hmm. So that's an opportunity for cemeteries, perhaps, but it's a challenge in other ways. So cemeterians get a bad rap sometimes. They're very entrepreneurial people, and I love problem solving with them at these events. Yeah, so that's what gives me.
Some of them are doing just beautiful work. Like, you see what they're doing with their cemetery space and the way that they're building out cremation gardens and things. It just, they're doing the Lord's work out there. Like and some of them are just the most creative people that you will ever meet. So I'm kind of jealous of your fall. Like, I've got some events coming up that I'm excited about, but not with, like, I'm not partying with the cemetery people the way that you will be. So you'll have to share what you learned.
No shade on funeral directors. You guys can, y'all can party too. Mm-hmm.
They can hang for sure. Hey. I mean, I grew up going to funeral conventions. I'm well aware that they
don't count out.
They know how that experience. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for your time today. This has just been such a great conversation. I want to have you back immediately because there's so much I want to ask you more about, but I know that you are very busy, so I appreciate your time. And I'm sure our listeners appreciate hearing from you and learning from you as well.
Well, thank you, Danielle. I'm happy to come back whenever you invite me. So this is super fun. I can't wait.
Awesome. Thank you very much.